Today is Wednesday, March 28th. We're going to work on more digestive system information today. Okay, let me take you back to page 90 at the very top. We're on page 90 at the very top. On Monday, we were talking about how the small intestine is this really important absorptive organ. So that's kind of where I want to take you back today. Okay, so in terms of absorption, the small intestine is it. That's where we do all of our absorption of nutrients. And on the top of page 90, we also see that we absorb electrolytes and water as well. You know, when we talk about electrolytes, we're talking about the ions in our bloodstream. Things like calcium and iron and sodium are absorbed here. And I wanted to be specific because you only take in iron and calcium if you need those. So if you are low on calcium, there's actually a hormone that we've talked about before that plays a role. Do you recall the name of the hormone that raises blood calcium levels? Parathyroid, good, PTH. So if you need more calcium, PTH will direct your intestines to absorb more of it from the food that you've got passing through. Let's see, we also take in sodium. It kind of buddies up with glucose and amino acids for absorption here, and potassium is also absorbed in your small intestine. So pretty soon we're going to be talking about fluid electrolyte balance, and I want to kind of gear your brain in that direction. If someone has diarrhea, we are not able to absorb these electrolytes. Maybe none at all, maybe a very few number of these electrolytes. When you think back to studying those osmotic pressures and hydrostatic pressures from an earlier chapter, which of those pressures depends upon your electrolytes, salts, and solutes? Osmotic or hydrostatic? Hydro means water, so it must be osmotic. Yeah. So if you have, say, a severe case of ongoing diarrhea and you lose these electrolytes from your body through diarrhea, then your osmotic pressure will drop. All right, so we know there's a push-pull battle. We know that osmotic pressure is the one that pulls the fluids back into the capillary. And if you happen to have lost your osmotic pressure, can you still return fluids back to your capillary? You cannot, right. So where do those fluids end up staying? Interstitial, good. And we call that excess tissue fluid?
Edema,
good. So unfortunately, this is kind of an important thing for us. If we happen to lose those electrolytes, we end up having swelling. It can alter our blood flow, our pressures, and end up causing edema. Speaking of water, we get most of our water from what we drink. We get some fluids from what we eat. We actually make around 10 liters or so of digestive juices per day. And most of that fluid, thankfully, is reabsorbed back into your bloodstream. You know, if you're looking at the picture and noticing that we make about a liter of saliva per day, 2 liters of gastric fluids, you know, this really begins to add up if you think about losing those fluids through vomiting and diarrhea. But we actually store most of our fluids in our cells. So even though this looks like a huge chunk of fluid that we're dealing with here, we actually have around 40-some liters of fluid that we've got in our bodies. Most of that is stored inside cells, about 20-something liters inside our cells. So even though we've got a lot of fluid, we only lose about 1% of the fluid secreted into our digestive system and our feces. So that means we're pretty efficient at taking fluids back into our bloodstream through absorption. And in fact, the small intestine is primarily where we reabsorb most of those digestive secretions. So without a small intestine, what do you think happens to all these fluids secreted into your GI tract?
They go to waste.
They go to waste. Yep, so out through the feces, and of course that can lead to dehydration. So yeah, we're pretty efficient at pumping out fluids and then just pulling them right back in. Okay, so let's see, we've got, I believe, the top of half of that page covered. Any questions on small intestine? So, you know, the fun is over. When you get to the large intestine, you are no longer talking about absorbing nutrients or breaking down food. this is the poop channel, right? You know, we're looking at carrying feces out of the body. We absorb a little bit of water and vitamins from here, but this is not the place for you to take in nutrients. So let's talk about structure first, and then we'll talk about what the large intestine does for us. All right, so about 5 feet in length, you know, if we were to stretch it out, no muscle tone. And the diameter, of course, is bigger than the small intestine, thus the name large intestine. The large and small intestine join on the right-hand side of your abdominopelvic cavity. They are connected by a sphincter called what? Ileocecal. Yeah, so the ileum of your small intestine and the cecum of your large intestine join at that ileocecal sphincter. Like I mentioned, this is the poop pathway, so we do not want anything in this large intestine to back up. That's why it is really important for that ileocecal sphincter to stay closed after food is pushed into this space. It is mixed with some bacteria that's pretty bad, like E. coli, and if that bacteria backs into your small intestine, what is your small intestine's main job?
Absorb.
So guess where that bacteria goes?
Into your bloodstream,
right. So that's why it's really important that that ileocecal sphincter be a shut doorway, no backups here, because we don't want that bacteria coming up into our small intestine. Okay, so we've got the cecum here on the right side. It has a little blind pouch hanging down here called the appendix, and it looks just like, got you a picture here. Oh, I thought I did. Maybe I don't. It looks just like regular digestive organ. It's got the same four layers that any other parts of your digestive tract have. It just happens to be a blind pouch where bacteria can get kind of rowdy. And unfortunately, if those bacteria cause an infection and the appendix ruptures, we know that can spread throughout your entire lower abdomen cavity by way of your mesentery. From the cecum, we're going to travel up through the colon, and the colon has several portions. The ascending portion takes us up the right side, and it makes a turn here at what organ?
Hepatic flex.
You're good. So the liver's sitting there. It comes across right below your belly button as the transverse colon, makes a left-hand turn at what organ?
Splenic
flex. You're good. Now we travel down the left-hand side. It makes an S-shaped curve at what part of the colon?
Sigmoid.
Good. And at that point, the rectum is the straight exit route from the large intestine. Interesting, they don't actually finish this picture. There, of course, is an anus at the end of the show here, you know, but they just don't include it on this picture. So the anus being the last terminal portion of a large intestine, that is the way we control the exit of feces. There's also a couple of features unique to the large intestine. We have this external band of the muscularis externa. This longitudinal band is called what?
Tenia coli.
Tenia coli, good. It makes these puckers called?
Hostra.
Good. And then there's these fat deposits on the outside surface. They're called?
Epiploic appendages.
Good. There's epiploic appendages, good. Okay. So inside the small or large intestine, rather, there are some villi, but they're not as pretty and as well-developed, you might say, as what we see in our small intestine. That's because we're not really absorbing nutrients here. The primary thing we absorb in the large intestine is water and some vitamins. So we're not really needing the fancy, well-developed villi once we get this far along in the digestive tract. So absorption here, primarily water. We do have our own natural population of bacteria. They say it's our own localized fauna, flora and fauna, and that bacteria actually helps us make some vitamins. What vitamins?
B
and K, good. So we do make a little bit of B and K in our large intestine. We absorb those vitamins into our bloodstream. All right, so that should take us over to top of page 91. Let me mention about a little bit about this bacteria. They say that we get our bacteria when we pass through our mother's birthing canal through at the time of birth. They say that's how we colonize a lot of our large intestine with bacteria. There have actually been studies done to compare babies born by C-section versus babies born through a birthing canal. And the ones born through the birthing canal, actually a vaginal birth, are the ones who pick up a better crop of bacteria for their own digestive tracts. So they are saying, you know, hey, if you can, a vaginal birth may be the better way to go for the baby's own digestive health. So interesting, you know, stuff out there, that what we pick up from just having a vaginal birth. Likewise, if someone takes a round of antibiotics, that can kill these naturally occurring bacteria in our large intestine. Now, if you kill off your bacteria, how does that impact your vitamin population?
It's going to drop.
Right, that's going to drop, right. So let's kind of come full circle. We've talked about vitamin K in the past. Do you recall why it's important? Blood, something about blood is right. Blood clotting, yeah. Good, so blood clotting may be impaired. You know, who thinks about this, right? I take antibiotics for an infection. And who thinks about, oh yeah, I killed my bacteria in the large intestine, and now I've got clotting issues because of this. So who thinks about these domino effect connections that we end up having?
My doctor.
Hopefully, yeah. So if you've got a patient who stays on a long-term course of antibiotics, that could impair their clotting issues. And if they've already got, say, you know, a drug in their system that causes them to impair clotting, then now you've got a complicating factor. Let's see, and we know that B vitamins like B12 are also important for what? Red blood cells, good. Okay. We also know that by the time we reach your digestive tract, what we're dealing with here is undigestible food waste. Most of this is parts of carbohydrates that we cannot digest. We cannot break down things like cellulose that comes in plant matter. So things like breads may contain cellulose, or certainly green leafy vegetables contain it. So that is what feces is largely composed of, is those undigestible food waste. What else would you expect to find in feces?
Corn,
definitely.
Water, mucus, bacteria.
Water, mucus, bacteria, good. Let me do your public service announcement here on poop color for just a moment. The brown color of feces actually comes from the breakdown of bile. So which organ makes bile?
Gallbladder.
Sure.
Stores bile,
right.
Yeah.
And the liver makes it. Okay. So if you actually have trouble making bile, you point your finger back at the liver. And if you don't have enough bile, you can't break down fats. So then feces will float because the fats are leaving with the digestive waste. Okay. But the other issue is, by traveling through your large intestine, that bile is broken down into something that's once was green, but now is brown in color. And the feces are colored brown thanks to the breakdown of bile. Now, if we notice somebody has light-colored pale stools, kind of like the color of these walls, then we say, okay, your bile is not leaving with the large intestine waste products like it should. We point the finger back at liver and or gallbladder for releasing that bile. So that is one clue we can pick up from looking at the color of our feces. Other things that can discolor feces are things like blood. A GI bleed somewhere can cause the feces to become black in color, and the most horrific smell you've ever encountered, right?
It's horrific either way.
It is horrific either way, but you add dried...
Forget this.
Yeah, dead red blood cells in there is just an awful odor. Yeah. So feces, of course, are eliminated through the process of defecation. Defecation is just fancy language for having a bowel movement. So I'd like to talk to you about the defecation process for just a moment. I know you're aware of how it works, right? Okay, but there's some background we'll talk about. Okay, so about middle of your page, there's a couple of things that happen to lead up to a bowel movement. One of those things is called a hostral contraction. And what this means is about every 30 minutes, feces are moved from one little hostra in your large intestine to the neighboring hostra. So the function there, I think I left you a blank, is to move feces from one hostra. The function is to move feces from one hostra to the next hostra. Move feces from one hostra to the next hostra. So if you're moving feces from one hospital to the next hospital, and that's what you're relying on for a bowel movement, it's going to be a long time coming. We've got a lot of feet here of large intestine to move through, and it takes somewhere between 12 and 24 hours to move the feces through the entire length of that large intestine. So there must be some other way in order to propel those feces toward the rectum down here. Normally, your rectum is empty. If you have feces in the rectum, you actually feel an urge to have a bowel movement. So what we're aiming for here is the goal of pushing those feces into the rectum and producing a bowel movement. So 3 to 4 times a day, you have a mass movement. Let me get you a picture. And this mass movement often follows the time when we eat. When you put food into your stomach, the stomach stretches. We send food over into the small intestine. And that creates a mass wave of peristalsis among your lower digestive organs. So it not just propels feces from one hospital to the next, it is a mass reflex that moves feces towards your rectum. Now, I'm not indicating that you are probably taking a poop 4 times a day. Some people may, but you have the opportunity to push those feces toward the rectum. You may not fill the rectum full of feces more than once a day or once every other day, but when the feces are pushed into the rectum and it starts to stretch, that's when we can stimulate a bowel movement. Okay, so eating can stimulate a mass movement, so can hot beverages. That's why a lot of people have their morning hot coffee followed by a morning bowel movement. You know, so hot meals, large meals, those kinds of things can stimulate one of these mass movements that propels those feces. So the final thing to happen is this defecation reflex, and that occurs when we start pushing feces into the rectum, and they slide down here into this anal canal region. At this point, there is a parasympathetic set of nerves in your sacral region that carries information up your spinal cord and up to your brain. Those nerves have a message. What's the message? Take a poop, right? Time to go. Okay, so at this point, you've got two sphincters. The internal anal sphincters, literally the ones that are inside, right here, these are made up of smooth muscle. They're going to open. Of course, you have the opportunity to keep the external anal sphincters closed. And because you're keeping them closed, what type of muscle must they be made of?
Skeletal.
They must be skeletal. Good. So the message that came to your brain that says time to have a bowel movement, you are then saying, okay, I want to either keep my external sphincter closed or it is an okay time to open it up. So either you go and you have a bowel movement, you push out the feces, or you maintain keeping those external sphincters closed. So again, if you say no, this is not the time, the message comes back down your spinal cord to a set of nerves here called splanchnic nerves. They're going to your rectum area. And that tells those external sphincters, not the time, this is not good, keep it closed. Okay, so we know how this works. The message finally gets down there, a few minutes pass, there is still pressure that's causing stretch in your rectum. So a few minutes later, what happens? I'm still here, right? Okay. So the message is still there. The message comes back up your spinal cord, back to your brain, and it says, hey, still got pressure here. You make the decision. You make the call, right? So eventually this message goes back and forth to your brain, to your external sphincter, until you make the decision. If there's enough pressure there, it may override your command, and you may have a bowel movement anyway. That's what happens, especially in people who have poor nervous system control over these sphincters. Babies have poor nervous system control. That's why they wear diapers. And older people who may have had a nervous system issue like a stroke also lose control over those external anal sphincters, keeping them closed. So, you know, anytime there's an interruption in that nervous system command to the sphincters, we no longer have control over keeping them closed. So ultimately, a defecation reflex pushes feces out of the rectum and the anal canal. It is a positive feedback mechanism. So what does that mean is happening here?
Encourages it,
right. So as long as you feel pressure to push, you push. And of course, the goal is to remove those feces from your anus. And then after the pressure is gone, no more stimulus. And then you no longer have the need to push. So it's going to be a positive feedback mechanism to have a bowel movement.
So
did want to mention to you this. In the anal canal region, there are anal columns. You can see them down below here. They're vertical. And what they do is expedite the exit of feces out of the anal region. Up higher in the anus, there are these things called anal valves. And they actually point up into the anus, because if your goal is only to pass gas and not to pass feces, those anal valves keep the feces from exiting normally, right? Okay, accidents do happen, but normally those valves are meant to keep whatever's solid in there inside. Okie doke. So we got through talking about poop.
What's the function for mass movement?
Mass movements propel feces to the rectum. Okay, so mass movements propel feces toward the rectum. Since we've talked about a few disorders here and there, I thought I'd mention to you some associated with the large intestine. The two images shown here are out pockets of the large intestine. They're called diverticulum, these little pockets here that you see. The leading cause of having a diverticulum form is having a hard bowel movement and straining to push it out. So that's why they say, you know, if you can increase your fiber intake and not have to push so hard, you can decrease the likelihood of these diverticulum forming. So if we consistently throughout our lifetime are straining really hard to have bowel movements, then you increase the likelihood of forming these. These diverticulosis here, this is simply a condition of having those diverticulum. If they become infected, you can see pus here, that then becomes a much more painful problem that has to be treated. What are some things that people may eat that will irritate and inflame those diverticulum?
Seeds.
Yeah. So tiny hard things like seeds from strawberries, tomatoes, even hard peanut parts can get in there, and that can irritate and cause the diverticulitis condition you see there on the right. So you can actually see some of these out pockets. They're really like blowouts on a tire. You know, if you push too hard, it just causes a weak part of the wall to expand. And these are not diamond rings. These are diverticulum with feces in them. Yeah. What's that? And all these little out pockets here are not supposed to be there. Your large intestine should not look bumpy like that. But, you know, nonetheless, feces can get trapped there, so can seeds, and there comes the infection.
What is that hemorrhoid basically? Is that
That is actually, let's see, that is this. It is varicose veins for the valves to fail in the anal region. And because the valves fail, the blood backflows. And if it's an internal hemorrhoid, then it's just a varicose vein inside. External hemorrhoids can be outside like this. And nonetheless, every time a person has a bowel movement, those thin-walled veins can be ruptured and bleed. So that is another good reason not to strain having a bowel movement, because pregnancy, obesity, and pushing out hard bowel movements can all lead to varicose veins in the anal region. Alright, so let's see. I think that is it for large intestine. I did put you some stuff there about constipation, diarrhea, and IBS. Just for FYI. What kind of questions do y'all have so far? So I'm hoping you're finding this chapter to be a little easier to digest, over the respiratory system, right? Yeah, the respiratory system's pretty heavyweight, so I'm hoping that when you study, you let me know what questions you have back there for respiratory that we can get. Okay, so looks like the accessory organs are next. That starts on page 92. And so we've actually talked about teeth and salivary glands, so we can check them off our list of to-do. We can then focus on pancreas, liver, and gallbladder. So we'll start off with the pancreas first. All right. right, so the pancreas is a triangular shaped organ. It is sitting behind your stomach, wedged up against the duodenum, and it actually has two functions. It serves a role as an exocrine gland and also serves a role as an endocrine gland. As an exocrine gland, it makes digestive juices to be secreted into your small intestine. Now, as an endocrine gland, we look at hormones like insulin and its antagonist, glucagon. So if you think back to what we studied a little earlier, there were islet cells that made those two hormones, insulin and glucagon, but now our focus is going to be for a different set of cells. They are called acini cells, and the acini cells make our digestive juices. Okay, so got your reminder there. Pancreatic islets make two hormones. They are antagonists. They were insulin and glucagon. Those two hormones that the pancreatic islets made is insulin and glucagon. So we'll put insulin and glucagon on the back burner for now. We've been through those. We'll come back to those again in the metabolism chapter. Let's instead focus on the role of the pancreas as an exocrine organ. And the digestive juices made here are destined for the small intestine. We know there's two main ducts or pathways that transport juices from your pancreas. We have a main pancreatic duct, and not shown in this picture, but there's also an accessory pancreatic duct. Good. So which of those two tubes, main or accessory, joins with the common bile duct?
The main one.
Yeah, the main one joins with the common bile. And where they come together, there's a little fattened area called the ampulla. And because we're joining tubes from the liver and the pancreas, we call it a hepatopancreatic ampulla. Now, there's a sphincter sitting there, also called hepatopancreatic sphincter, and that regulates the exit of both bile from the liver and gallbladder and pancreatic juices into what part of your small intestine? Duodenum. Good. And in fact, you can see a little tip opening there. It's called a papilla inside the small intestine. That little tip ending is the
major
good.
Duodenal lung.
That's it, good. Major duodenal or duodenal papilla, good. All right, so let's focus then on what is made by these acini cells. Keeping in mind, these are not the cells that make insulin and glucagon. These are not endocrine in nature. These are actually exocrine cells. They're kind of like sweat glands in that nature in that they're making some kind of substance that will be excreted from them. There's two types of pancreatic juices down near the bottom of your page. You have an enzyme-rich pancreatic juice. And down there, number two, very bottom, bicarbonate-rich pancreatic juice. Let's take a step back for just a moment. We've talked about all of our major digestive organs. Which digestive organ is the primary one for breaking down all of our food groups and absorbing them?
Small intestine.
Good. So these small intestine makes its own enzymes, but it also gets some help from the pancreas. We have pancreatic amylase secreted by the pancreas for the intestines. What does amylase help us break down?
Starch
into sugars. Good. Okay, so that's a blank for us. Pancreatic amylase helps us break down starch into sugars. There's another one here called pancreatic lipase. ASE says, I'm an enzyme. The lipase prefix is indicative of a lipid. So what kind of things are we breaking down here? Fats into fatty acids and glycerol. Good. So those two blanks are fatty acid and glycerol. I mentioned to you the other day that these SIN words were a ringing bell for those pepsins and protein digesting enzymes. And here again, we've got more SIN words. trypsin and chymotrypsin, those two syn words are related to protein breakdown, and the building blocks of proteins are what?
Amino acids.
Good, amino acids. So we can actually live without our pancreas. You know, the intestines can handle the job. We do then develop diabetes without a pancreas because of the lack of insulin regulating blood glucose levels. But the typical issue here is if someone develops pancreatic cancer, then there's hardly any symptoms until that cancer has advanced to other organs and metastasized. So if there is a way to catch the cancer in the pancreas early enough, then they may be able to save, you know, that person's life. But you know, left till, say, stage 3 or 4, then it becomes more difficult to remove the cancers that may have spread to other organs. All right, so the second type of fluid that's produced by the pancreas important to digestion is a bicarbonate-rich fluid. And the term bicarbonate there is something we've seen before. When you think about these bicarbonate fluids, you want to think about it being an alkaline or a basic chemical, okay? So when you hear the word bicarbonate from the pancreas, you want to think of it as being an alkaline or a basic chemical. So let's take a look at our big picture. The food we were just digesting in the stomach is being pushed into the small intestine a little bit at a time. You know, at the height of digestion, what was the pH of our stomach's chyme? 1 or 2, good. So really, really acidic. So coming into the small intestine here is this acid-rich digested food. And we know the main job of the small intestine is to finish breaking down those nutrients and then absorb them into the bloodstream. If we don't do anything, we're going to end up absorbing acid directly into our bloodstream. What is blood pH supposed to be?
7.35 to 7.45.
Okay, so here's your problem, right? You've got pH of 1 coming into the duodenum or duodenum. Your blood pH is up here at 7.4. If you absorb acid into the bloodstream, what happens to your blood pH?
It's
going to plummet, right? So we've got to do something to make sure that what we're absorbing into the bloodstream is pretty close to a 7.4 pH. So you'll notice this bicarbonate fluids coming from your pancreas into your small intestine have a range between around 7.4 and 7.8. The goal here is to, or rather, the goal is to move that pH up to about 7.4 to 7.8. That way, what you're bringing into the bloodstream is a little closer to blood pH. All right, so I've got a blank there for you. It says, why is it important, very bottom of the page, why is it important for chyme in the small intestine to be near about a 7 or so or higher? We want to move that pH closer to blood pH. Okay, so it's important to move that pH closer to blood pH. Sure. It's important to move that pH of chyme closer to blood pH. Okay, so we want to move that pH of chyme closer to blood pH. I know that word looks like chyme. It's chyme. It's the digested, broken up food particles in your stomach that get pushed into your small intestine. We want to move it closer to blood pH, 7.4. It's amazing how our perspectives change, you know. We think tonsils are bad. Take them out, right? So we learn a little more and realize they're much more important than we thought. Okay, so here's the problem. When food comes into your small intestine, how does your pancreas know it's time to release these juices, enzymes, and bicarbonate-rich fluids into your duodenum?
Because of acid in the chyme.
Acid in the chyme is a trigger, good. And so there's an issue here because we need to tell the pancreas, hey, time for your stuff, right? So in order to get those secretions to come into the small intestine, we need to send a message to your pancreas that says, hey, pump your stuff in, food's here. So if you wanted to send a message, you could send a hormone. And how does the hormone get from the small intestine to the pancreas?
Bloodstream,
right. So that's in fact what happens. When you have food, acid-rich or protein-rich food, come into your small intestine, the small intestine says, hey, send a message to the pancreas, tell them we're ready. And the pancreas, in turn, will then release those fluids by way of the main or accessory duct into the small intestine. And when the food exits the small intestine, there's no more message being sent, and so the pancreas stops releasing its secretions. All right, so I think we're ready to turn over to page 93. Let me introduce you to two hormones. So no joke, when we started this class and I mentioned the endocrine system would never leave us, here it is again, right? So there's two hormones there, secretin and cholecystokinin, but you can call it CCK for short. Let's talk about secretin first. Secretin is a hormone made by your small intestine. What kind of foods trigger the release of secretin? Acids, good. So, in fact, your small intestine is an endocrine organ. It releases secretin, and like all hormones, it travels the bloodstream. Now, there's two target organs of secretin. Not only does secretin talk to your pancreas, it also talks to what other organ?
The liver.
The liver, good. So let's take pancreas first. When acid comes into your small intestine releases secretin. Secretin comes to your pancreas and says to your pancreas, we've got acid, you need to neutralize it. So what kind of juice should we release into the small intestine?
Bicarbonate rich.
Bicarbonate rich, good. What will that do to the acid in the small intestine?
Raise the pH.
Balance out that pH, good. So bring that pH up closer to 7.4. So when food, especially acid-rich food, comes into the small intestine says, time for the bicarbs. Tell the pancreas by releasing secretin. Secretin says, hey pancreas, release your bicarbonate-rich fluids. They come back through the main or accessory ducts back into the small intestine. So that does, you're right, help us neutralize that pH. So there's another target of secretin, and that is the liver. What does the liver now make and send to the small intestine?
Bile.
Bile, good. So what does bile help to break apart?
Fats,
good. We talked about it being an emulsifier. That means that it takes big globs of fat and breaks them into smaller, more manageable pieces. Okay, let's turn our attention now to the other hormone called cholecystokinin, or CCK for short. Let me give you a really helpful clue. If you break the word cholecystokinin down, the prefix col, C-H-O-L-E, means bile. Okay, so C-H-O-L-E means bile. The second part of the word cysto, or cyst, means what? Cyst means bladder. Kinin means move. Okay, so technically this word means bile, bladder, move. So what are we telling the gallbladder to do? Well, if we want it to move, we want the bile to come. Yeah. Make it come back out. Make that bile move, come back out, let it go down to the small intestine. So what kind of food must be there in the small intestine waiting for that bile?
Fats.
Good. So there's two target organs of CCK. Gallbladder is one of them. The other one is the pancreas. So this time, fatty foods in the small intestine are the trigger or stimulus for the release of CCK. Like all hormones, CCK travels the bloodstream. It has two target organs. This time, it's pancreas and gallbladder. What message does CCK have for your gallbladder? Yep, release the bile. The bile comes through the cystic duct, down the common bile. We join with that main pancreatic duct and we dump that bile into the small intestine. The message is also being sent by CCK to your pancreas. The pancreas then releases a specific type of fluid. What does it contain?
Enzymes,
good. So now we're gonna dump amylase, we're gonna dump lipase, trypsin and chymotrypsin into the small intestine, and that helps us break down and hydrolyze those foods. So in reality, what we're doing is releasing them simultaneously because most likely we have an acid-rich chyme that's got some fats in there, so most likely we've got both of these hormones being dumped at the same time. Interesting things they're learning about CCK. It plays a lot of different roles in our bodies. It also tells the stomach to slow its activities. So it also has other target organs besides just the two we've discussed. So I tell you what, my helpful hint for keeping this straight, I remember that CCK stands for bile bladder move. That tells me that we're talking to the gallbladder. And then I don't have to memorize what secretin is because, well, it's the other organ, it's the liver. So the pancreas is actually a target of both CCK and secretin. All you need to keep straight is which hormone tells which fluid to be released. And so secretin tells the pancreas to release a neutralizing bicarbonate-rich fluid. CCK, on the other hand, tells the pancreas to release enzyme-rich fluid. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to memorize every last bit of this, but keep little triggers there for you to keep it straight. How about questions so far on the pancreas? Want to do it again? Feel pretty good? Do it again? Okay. Okay, so you just ate, your meal is over, food is coming from your stomach into your small intestine. The small intestine says, hey, I need help digesting this stuff. So the small intestine is stimulated by fats. Let's do it this way. We're stimulated by fats. So which hormone is now being released? CCK. Good. CCK has two targets. What are they? Pancreas and the gallbladder. Good. And because we have fat sitting in the small intestine, we need bile to come. What does bile do to the fats there?
It breaks them.
Good. Breaks them in from big pieces to smaller pieces. And the fancy word for that is emulsification. Okay, so it's a weird word, emulsification. It's emulsification. There it is on the board for you. So let me be real careful here with the way I say this. Bile breaks up fat like Dawn dishwashing liquid breaks apart grease. All bile does is takes big globs of fat and breaks them into more manageable pieces. I'm being really careful not to use a word here that's not correct for bile, and that is hydrolyze, because there is another chemical called lipase that actually hydrolyzes fats into their little building blocks. So they're kind of a tag team. Bile is like the big heavy. It comes in and says, all right, punch, punch, break apart these big globs of fat. And lipase is the one that's detailed. It comes in and takes the, it really disassembles the fats into their building blocks. So they're a tag team. You've got to have both of them to properly break apart fats. Now, if you don't have bile, lipase says, hey, I can't work with this huge blob of fat, so it ends up leaving in our feces, and we have really fatty feces that float. So if you've ever had a greasy meal, I don't know if you, this is really a very personal question, but if you turn around and check out what you've left behind, you may in fact notice that after a greasy meal, the feces float. And that's because you've got to have that bile there to break down, break apart those big blobs of fat. Okay, so lipase is kind of left helpless, you might say, without bile helping it out. Right, right, because it's kind of like a backup assist for that bile release. Okay, so we were talking about CCK, and the trigger for CCK was fatty foods in the small intestine. We know that CCK targets your gallbladder, making it release bile. What is the other target of CCK?
Pancreas.
Good. And what does the pancreas release?
Enzyme-rich juices.
Good. Enzyme-rich juices, right. So things like lipase, trypsin and chymotrypsin, and amylase. So what is the destination for those enzymes? Where do we put them?
Small intestine,
good, good. Let's see, what does trypsin, chymotrypsin, pepsin, what do they all hydrolyze?
Pepsin hydrolyzes
proteins, good. And amylase breaks down starches into?
Sugars,
good. And how about lipase? It hydrolyzes?
Fatty acids,
good. So it breaks down those fats into their building blocks, good. Okay, so secretin is the other hormone. It is triggered or stimulated by
what?
Acids, good. So acids coming into your small intestine. The small intestine then in turn releases secretin. Secretin has two targets,
pancreas
and liver, good. What does the liver release?
Bile.
Okay, and bile comes from these hepatic ducts. It comes down this common bile duct, joins with the main pancreatic duct, and now dumps that bile into the small intestine. The other target of secretin was pancreas, and because we had acids in the small intestine, what kind of fluids do we now need to release?
Bicarbonate rich,
good. And how does that help us out?
It raises the pH.
Keep your pH, right, so make it around 7.4, good. One of the things people often miss when we talk about this on testing is where those hormones are made. So secretin and CCK are made where?
Small intestine,
that's right. Okay, so just keep that in mind. Secretin and CCK, they are made by your small intestine. So that looks like that page is done. How about questions so far? Looks like we have liver and gallbladder, and that's left on pages 94 and 95. Really, a very large digestive organ. We're talking about the liver now. It has two very big lobes, a right lobe, okay, and it's also got a left lobe. And on the back side, you can more easily see that caudate and quadrate lobe. We know there's a falciform ligament right through the left and the right lobes that separates those two. Interesting trivia tidbit about that falciform ligament. Before you were born, you were kept alive in utero by umbilical arteries and veins. Those umbilical vessels actually travel through your liver, and they linked up with these two large vessels back here, aorta and IVC. Once we're born, we no longer need an umbilical cord, so the umbilical cord is cut, and these vessels that once traveled through this little split in the liver kind of, you know, they kink up and they close up. They're no longer necessary, and what's left behind is the remnant of those vessels. That becomes the falciform ligament. So interesting little tidbit about that piece of ligament that's now situated between those two main lobes. So the liver has a lot of functions that we're going to talk about. One of them, though, happens to be taking nutrients out of the bloodstream and storing them. And one of the most important ones that we may take out and store is sugar. So thinking back to the endocrine system, which hormone helps us store excess blood sugar?
Insulin.
Insulin, good. So in fact, insulin may help us take and remove extra blood sugar stored in the liver. And thinking way back, what is the polysaccharide form of glucose?
Glycerol.
You're close. It starts with glycogen. Yeah. So in fact, if you do need to store sugar as glycogen, you can do so in the liver if insulin is there, they are directing what to do. So this is actually a flow pathway from the intestines to the liver, and it's a bypass. Normally, most veins dump blood right back into either SVC or IVC. But this flow pattern that you're looking at is called hepatic portal circulation, and it bypasses, or it actually is a bypass through the liver. Ultimately, we do make it back to the IVC, but we're going to let the liver take dibs on what it wants to store first. So let me show you a picture of what we're coming from. We've talked about your small intestine being a real important site for absorption. When we absorb those nutrients, we pull them through these finger-like extensions called what?
Microvilli.
Villi and microvilli, good. Inside of those villi are capillaries, and that's kind of where we left the conversation. So we assume that once we get blood into a capillary, it goes to a venule and then to a vein. So we really didn't pick the conversation any further. Now, let's take the conversation here. I know you guys have seen superior and inferior mesenteric veins in lab. That ring a bell? Okay. So those veins are actually pulling blood that is nutrient-rich away from these intestines. Normally, we would say, since they're veins, they're going to take it to the IVC. Well, we'll get there eventually, but we're going to take a detour or a bypass through the liver first. So we're just going to pick this one. We're going to pick superior mesenteric vein. We're going to let the blood flow from that vein toward the liver. You're going to actually pick up blood from a lot of other veins. You'll notice splenic vein, for instance, joins. There's a gastric vein here. But we end up taking this nutrient-rich blood to a hepatic portal vein. That hepatic portal vein is on the back side or posterior side of the liver. We're bringing nutrient-rich blood into the liver. All right, so here we come, hepatic portal vein, and then it disappears into the inner structure of the liver. So let me flip pictures. This here is a branch of the hepatic portal vein, and it is set up with these rings of liver cells. If you had to name a liver cell, what would you call it? Call it a hepatocyte. Good. So there are these layers and layers of hepatocytes situated around these vessels. What we do is we let this nutrient-rich blood come up from this hepatic portal vein. It travels a vessel called a sinusoid through those hepatocytes. If insulin is sitting there, what do we take out of the bloodstream?
Sugar.
Sugar, yeah. And we put it in those hepatocyte cells, and we store it as glycogen. And what we end up doing is taking that blood over here to a central vein. And you know, normally there's one central vein in an organ, but this time there's lots of central veins in the middle of these rings of hepatocytes. And those central veins ultimately carry the blood out of the liver. So let's go back to the big picture. These intestines are picking up nutrients. The nutrients are carried up here toward the liver, and the vessel that carries blood into the liver is called what? Hepatic portal vein. Good. And I make the point about it because there is also a set of hepatic veins here. They're totally different though. They're carrying blood out of the liver, not into the liver. So when we get into the liver with these hepatic portal veins branch off and they're set up around these liver cells called hepatocytes. A branch of this vessel comes off. It's called a sinusoid. And now is our opportunity for us to store items in the liver. If you've got excess sugar, you may store it as glycogen. If you've got heavy metals like lead or arsenic, they'll be also pulled out and stored in the liver. If alcohol is in the bloodstream, it's stored in these hepatocytes. If you've got medications, Tylenol, Advil in your bloodstream, they're stored in your liver. If you take a prescribed medication, it's stored in the liver. Whatever you put in your mouth that ends up in your intestines and the bloodstream, the liver says, I get first dibs. Okay? So that means any medication you take, anything you drink, anything you eat, ends up in your bloodstream and comes through this pathway. So this branch of the hepatic portal vein takes us through a sinusoid, hepatocytes store stuff, and we end up exiting by way of this central vein. So when we look big picture, there's the central vein in the middle, and these are branches of the hepatic portal vein at each corner that are feeding into that central vein. Alright, so that central vein ultimately takes blood out of the liver toward the hepatic veins. And so here comes in, let's go backwards, here it comes out. Okay, so these little branches are hepatic veins, they are receiving blood from those central veins, and what exits now should be cleaner blood. So interesting, by the time you get back to your IVC and to your right atrium of your heart, you've been through this massive cleaning effort, this detoxification effort here by your liver. Okay, so this is actually a guaranteed essay. You can use this one as one of your answers if you choose to do so. It's halfway down the page. And like I mentioned earlier at the start of class, I believe I asked you on the test to take that thing, that tracing, not just stopping at the right atrium, but take me to the left atrium, somewhere in that neighborhood. So you'll just want to link that up with blood flow. Okay, so down near the bottom of your page, you've got a little bit on bile. Bile, of course, is made by the liver. Where is bile stored?
Stored in the gallbladder.
Stored in the gallbladder, good. Top of the next page has a list of the other functions related to digestive function. The liver can store glucose, we know that. If insulin is present, fat-soluble vitamins may also be stored here. Those fat-soluble vitamins, you may recall, are A, D, E, and K. The liver also makes plasma proteins like albumin. They're important for maintaining blood osmotic pressure. And the liver is also a detoxification center. That's why it takes out alcohol, medications, prescription drugs. Anything you take by mouth ends up being distributed through the liver hepatocytes. Likewise, the liver breaks down bilirubin. It is a pigment that is found in bile. Bilirubin, you may recall, comes from hemoglobin. Okay. So in the interest of time, I'm going to let you guys read about hepatitis and cirrhosis there, jaundice, and then let me take you down to the gallbladder. Okay, on what lobe of the liver is the gallbladder located?
On the quadrant.
What lobe?
The quadrant.
The right. Yeah, the right side. The only function for your gallbladder is to store and release bile, and it does so by concentrating the bile. It removes the water. So when the liver gets the message to make bile and release it, some of that bile may back up our cystic duct, that's our blank. Okay, so when the gallbladder stores bile, it comes into it by way of backing up that cystic duct. And when your gallbladder is told to release bile, which hormone has that job? Good, CCK, good. So when we store bile and release bile, we have to dehydrate it for storage, and then we rehydrate it with fluids to release it back down into the duodenum. Hey, something to appreciate here. If somebody has gallstones, those gallstones may sit down here in the bottom of the sac and cause no problems at all. They may show up on a scan. They may see them sitting there. They may have no problems at all. When they get ejected into the cystic duct, now we got problems. When they get ejected further into the common bile duct, now we got really big problems. because we're blocking bile completely from leaving the liver and gallbladder. Here's where you can end up with really bad problems. If those gallstones make it down here to this ampulla, it not only blocks bile from liver and gallbladder, what else does it block?
It blocks the pancreatic.
Yeah, now what is not getting into your small intestine?
Basically everything the pancreas can.
That's what happened to me. I was hospitalized. I had no idea what it was, obviously, at first, but I felt like I was going to die. And I actually had pancreatitis.
Wow.
And it was so bad. My pancreatitis was so bad that they said if I would have waited too much longer, I could have died from it.
Wow.
And they said I also had gallstones, which ended up after they got my enzymes to a safe level of my pancreas, I had my gallbladder removed because of it.
So no more of that blockage going on.
But, yeah,
wow.
Painful.
I imagine that would make you feel terrible. That's a very sensitive area with all that going on. Wow.
Well, just let me give you a story.
But I know that was connected like that.
Yeah. So yeah, you're right, you can end up with gallstones here, have pancreatitis, bile can't get out, so yeah, you got big issues down there. And your parting thought today, this is what gallstones can look like. They can be even bigger. So they're mostly cholesterol, so the more fatty foods you eat, you know, because they're breaking down fats, the more they have to, the fluids have to be injected. So they say that if you're eating a fatty diet, that we have a higher likelihood of developing those. Yeah. All right, so we will do metabolism on Monday. You bring your questions. Y'all have a good weekend.